This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but it has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program. Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week, we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This man calls Melbourne home. His voice is synonymous with the latest world and national news, and while you may have him in your lounge room each night, you may not be aware that this man has made some amazing achievements in charities right across the country. But of course, he is best known for presenting the Nine News weeknights on Channel 9. He can also be heard regularly on 3RW Melbourne, Bay FM Geelong, and Melbourne's Light FM. His presence is a total mixture of charm and authority, and whether the news is good or bad, he knows just how to break a story and commands the right amount of respect to the audience. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Peter Hitchener to Word for Word.
Hello, I'm Peter Hitchener.
I grew up in the country, miles from anywhere. After the Black Saturday bushfires, we went out into the field.
A state disaster plan has been declared with calls for army personnel to join volunteers fighting the fires.
Peter, how many years have you been in our lounge rooms for?
Well, I've worked for Channel 9 since 1973.
He's just a wonderful, wonderful man, and he's so funny and hilarious and loving and sweet and generous.
A lifetime of news.
He was the one who told Australia that Princess Diana had died.
He's entirely who he is, on camera as he is off camera.
That's what resonates, and I think that's why he's been so successful.
There are times during the news when Hitchie just loses it.
I think belonging is something we all have the need to feel.
Police say they hope someone burdened with information will help solve a 27-year-old gangland murder.
Peter Hitchener. Experience. Integrity. Trust.
Knowing that he's delivering it with heart and
he is truly the real deal.
He doesn't fake it.
Melbourne's number one news. Nine News with Peter Hitchener. See it first.
Benjamin, thank you. After that introduction, I think I might just go home right here and now because from here on in, it's going to be all downhill.
It's very bizarre. And after doing this show for a while, I often say this to people at this point. It's weird when people read back your achievements to you like this.
Well, yes, and you think, oh, no, I think this is sounding a bit inflated, so let's talk about something else. The weather, what a beautiful day it is in Melbourne.
Well, we could talk about the weather, but we're going to be talking about you. Over the last few days, I have been saying to people that I was going to interview you, and it was the strongest and nicest response I've had leading up to an interview.
Oh, thank you.
Is it strange after all these years that you have such a strong response with your audience?
Well, people are nice to me. People are kind to me. And I know how grateful I am for that because, you know, people don't have to be kind or nice to anyone. But I welcome it and I'm very lucky. I know how lucky I am. You know, I engage where possible, on, say, on social media rather than just try to just respond to people who respond to me because I think if you don't, it's just rude.
The one thing I've worked out, because I've been following for the last few years, and the thing that I think it makes you so great, it's what you put out into the universe that seems to be what you get back. I mean, you're a good person, so that's what seems to be coming back at you.
Well, Thank you. Somebody once said that if you have an angry email to send, sleep on it. If you're going to, you know, sleep on it before you press that send button. And generally speaking, so far on Twitter or other social media, if somebody says something that's just a bit out of line, I try not to respond. And if I'm tweeting, I just try to tweet something positive. You know, there's nothing like a nice picture of a Melbourne sunrise or something just to make you feel good.
To calm someone down.
Yes. And I think we can all do with some positive input along the way. So,
absolutely.
You know, here am I spending time looking at Nature is Amazing on Twitter, for instance. Not that Twitter's my obsession, because it's not. But you know, and you see cute animals and things, and it just can't help but make you feel better. So I don't know. It's maybe I'm just a simple soul from the bush, which is where I came from.
Well, that's right. Mm. I think which is what we should get into now. So originally, yeah. You're from Queensland, were you?
Actually, country Queensland, outside, not even in the town, but about 30 or 40 k's outside, a little town called Texas, which is a border town between Queensland and New South Wales. You know, the wiggly bit, if you can picture the line of the states, there's a wiggly bit in the southeast and right in there. And then I went to boarding school because we didn't have secondary schools really close by. So I went to a boarding school on the Gold Coast, then lived in Brisbane and worked in Brisbane when I started radio and things, and then eventually ended up in Melbourne, which I got here and I thought, wow, have you ever seen anything like this? Driving along Royal Parade, because one of the station execs picked me up from the airport, and he constructed this nice drive. So we went along Royal Parade in Parkville, and it was in June, so all the, you know, the deciduous trees had lost their leaves and they were just looking amazing. And I thought, wow, how good is this? And then St Kilda Road, and we drove over the Swan Street Bridge looking up at the city, and I thought, oh my gosh, look at this. I think I've found where I want to live.
This is home.
This is home. And it is, and it, all these years later, it's just glorious. And I think I have the fervor of a convert when it comes to Melbourne, because you know, I think if you were born here, you could probably just take all this stuff for granted, not realizing this is amazing. How good is this?
It is fantastic. I think, you know, I've just gone and I've done 3 years of breakfast radio in central Queensland, and then I've just come home.
Oh, welcome home.
And makes you feel very appreciative of everything that we do have here in Melbourne.
Yes. What part of central Queensland were you at?
Well, I was actually broadcasting out of Gladstone.
Right, yep.
But the show, which was for Southern Cross or Stereo, was out to Rockhampton, to Emerald, to 1770,
yep.
To Yeppoon.
Yep, so I know the area. In fact, when I worked at the ABC in Brisbane, my second job was after 4BH Monitor News, which was my first job. Then I went to the ABC. And because I was the youngest and didn't have kids, you know, I was single, so I got sent to relieve the announcers in the various places when they went on holiday. So I've been to Rocky and Townsville and Cairns and Yeppoon and everywhere else, the gem of the Coral Coast Festival, all those sort of things.
Yeah.
So I know the area. So you were lucky. Gladstone's a nice place too.
Yeah, I had a good time while I was there.
Mm.
But going back to Texas, what were you like as a child growing up?
Oh, it's just like any other kid, I think, in the bush. You see, this is years before television. We had radio, and so I grew up listening to a lot of news, much more than kids would today, because that's what my parents listened to. And our newspapers arrived about a day late, and as did fresh bread. So, you know, it was life in the bush. It was terrific. We rode horses. We just had a great time. I think it's a for me anyway, and my sister, we agree on this. It was a good way of growing up. But then you have to, when you hit the big smoke, you think, wait a sec, am I ready for this? Because it, you know, it's a sort of a simpler life there.
It's a huge difference, though.
It is, and not to say that life in the bush isn't tough, because it really is, and it can be. I know that my dad was, you know, was forever dealing with high interest rates or floods or famine or fire or low wool prices or something. You know, there was always something that was troubling. And, you know, so I know people in the bush do it very hard. And And I thought, well, I love it here, but I think I'd like to do something else. And and I chose television.
What a career to go after. Yes. But what was your relationship like with your parents growing up?
Oh, fabulous. Oh, it was wonderful. It was kind of idyllic, and that's not just with the benefit of hindsight. That's how it felt at the time. You know, you just, oh, this is terrific. We went to a one-teacher school, my sister and I went to a one-teacher school with 18 kids at its zenith. I think it varied between 18 and 20, but when I was there, 18 was about as the most it got to.
Yeah.
One room, one teacher, all classes up to grade 8.
Wow.
Which would now be sort of an equivalent of year 6, I suppose. So it was all the primary years in this one teacher school. It was great.
I'd hate to be
fun.
That teacher, having to try and
balance
it all out.
Well, yes, but the thing is, it was an interesting way of learning because you take bits and pieces of every grade's lessons. So it sort of gives you a very rounded sort of education, I think, up to year 8 or year 6 or whatever.
And you were very close. I mean, you've always been very close with your sister. What's the age difference between the two of you?
Oh, I'm 5 years older than she is.
So you're the big brother?
I'm the big brother, yes.
Yeah, so and, she gets to look up to you.
I look up to her because she's amazing. but we get on famously and I don't know, we've always just been, you know, just been able to, you know, we've got each other's back sort of thing.
It's such a good quality to have.
It's terrific. And it's very nice to have somebody who's, my sister is very, very discerning and very smart and very, very bright. And so she's a wonderful support. And yet, you know, she's quite discerning nonetheless. And can, if need be, say, well, look, I don't necessarily agree with that.
I think that's sometimes good relationship, though.
Yes.
I think you want to be able to spar off someone in a way. It would be boring if people just agree with you all the time.
Yes, that's right. Well, we do pretty much agree, and we never fight. We never fight. Never. Never, never, never. Not even a cross word. We just, you know, just one of those. She's one of those people you just get on with. She's really nice.
And what was the dynamic that you sort of played in your family growing up? Did you have a role that you played with your mum and your dad and your sister?
Let me think. I can remember enjoying making them laugh. And my mother, my sister and I both agree that our mother was hilariously funny and very entertaining and very, I don't know, she was just one of those people who everyone loved and got on with. And so was my dad. My dad was very popular and very, you know, it was just, I know it sounds idyllic and it sounds like I'm looking at all through rose-coloured glasses, but actually it was like that. You know, they were just nice and fun and we just had a good old time and we all just, you had that great feeling of belonging in our family. And
I'd believe that from you, though. But you know what? I've heard people say when they try and look back at it with rose-coloured glasses and you think, oh, I wonder if it was really like that. But from you, I think just based on your character and the way that you come across, I could believe that you did have this idealistic life with your Australian family.
I think we did. And the thing is, when I came to Melbourne to live, I could see that the job was going to keep me here, because I love the place, and also because the job was very engaging and it was an exciting time to work in television. And so I said to my family, to my mother and by then my stepfather, because my dad died when I was 17, and my mum later remarried many years later. And I said to my mum and stepfather and my sister, look, I'm going to be in Melbourne for a long time. They were living in Queensland. I said, why don't you consider coming down here and so that we can all stay close? Mm. And thanks to them, they did. And it was marvellous because then we had, you know, 30 years or more of, you know, family life. Not all living in the same house, I might tell you, but you know, that sort of that close contact.
Yeah.
That reassuring, you know, it's just really, it's really important. And I'm very lucky to have had that close family life.
What happened to your dad?
He had a series of strokes and passed away. Now, in this day and age, his life would have been saved, and you know, because of the advancements, I think, in medical science and the ability to deal with stroke and stroke prevention as well. But back then, it was all pretty basic, and you know, not much that they could do. And it's, you know, it's very, the loss of a parent is horrible, whatever age it happens. I think, and I was 17, my sister was 12, And it was, you know, especially hard for her, poor little thing. But we dealt with it as you do.
Mm.
And then my mum only passed away a few years ago, and that just the same. It was just a shocking wrench. It's like a.
I always say to people, I lost my father when I was 26, and I believe that when a parent dies, it's like a gravitational pull. It feels very deep. And even if you know it's coming, and I have had that as well with my stepfather when he passed away, I knew it was happening. But when a parent leaves, it makes an impact on you that is indescribable.
Mm. And in a way, you never get over it. But that pang, that knife in the chest that you feel initially when you think about the loss of a parent, it diminishes in that it doesn't happen all the time. But when you do think about it, it's just as painful.
What impact did that have on you and your sister?
Well, we had to start a new life, really. You know, it made it quite urgent for me to decide, well, what am I going to do for a career? My sister continued her studies, but our mum moved away from the bush because it wasn't really sustainable anymore. And so it helped sort of concentrate the mind. What am I going to do? How are we all going to look after one another? And
sort of forced you to grow up a bit.
Oh, it certainly did. And yes, well said.
And then what, you decided that you were going to go and look into this career of going into media.
Mm.
What sort of schooling did you have
for
that?
What happened was I was at school. Just a couple of things. I was thinking about this today. One of them was I discovered when I went away to boarding school, as I said, you sometimes hit the big smoke, not prepared for what lies ahead. And I was very naive, innocent. I had no idea about the dynamics of that sort of thing, especially as I was a year younger and smaller than everybody else.
Mm.
So I discovered that a way of avoiding bullying and so on was to entertain or be a clown or just deflect the, you know, whatever was going on, deflect it to away from me. And almost at the same time, we had a group. There was a group of Shakespearean players came to visit our school. And at the age of 12, I saw Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespearean. And I was just transfixed. I thought, oh, my gosh, I'd never seen anything quite like it. And it was just quite transforming. And I thought, wow, there is a way of entertaining people and getting to people that's makes a difference. I'm not quite sure what that difference is to this day, but it was something that fascinated me. And so I thought, well, I think that's what I might try to do. So I started off when I left school and started didn't finish uni. I lasted about a semester, and then I discovered that I was having way more fun working in radio, a job that I'd got. And
well, you have the voice for it.
Well, no, I don't think so. Well, thank you, but I kept thinking, actually, I think I'm going to. I don't think I could be bothered studying. Don't tell any students this. I'm sorry. In this day and age, you really must study, and you must get, if you can, get your degree and network and do all the things that you need to do, especially if you want to be a broadcaster.
Oh, you do need to do the work.
You've got to do the work now.
It's different, though, looking back at where you were at that day and age compared to what it is now.
It is. You didn't need the academic qualifications, but you needed luck because it's always been hard to get in. But I talk to journalism students these days about follow your dreams, your dreams, believe in yourself, be resilient, because that's always been a requirement, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's what happened to me. I was going to do acting, or was I going to do radio? And then radio came along, and I thought, oh, actually, I like this.
I like radio as well because, I mean, you don't have to do the hair and makeup as well.
Well, not only that, but radio just appeals to the imagination. People, having their own discourse with whoever's talking on the radio or whatever's going on the radio, it sort of engages the person. Television does, but in a different way, because all the pictures are done for you, whereas in radio, especially in the days of radio plays, because the ABC used to do radio plays.
Yeah, right.
And
People loved them sitting around listening to them.
Yes, and even the commercial radio used to do, the Lux Radio Theatre, for instance, on a Sunday night was huge, as I understand it. And Blue Hills from the novel by Gwen Meredith. I was never in Blue Hills, but when I went to Sydney with the ABC, I actually got to do the booth announcements for it.
Coming up.
Yes, the ABC presents Blue Hills from the novel by Gwen Meredith. And then they bring up the music, and then there was a little spiel about, you know, Granny is knitting mittens or something, and then the actors took over. So
it's so funny. So that's how I started. I was watching the telly movie of Peter Allen, and in Peter Allen's story, you saw him sitting around with his mum listening to those sorts of stories being played on the radio, and that was his first touch. From what that story told, or whether or not it's true, you know, that was where he got that bug of wanting to go into entertainment, you know, which I thought was, fascinating, because that was what happened back in those days in Australia.
That's right, because pre-TV, I think he spent some time on Bandstand with the wonderful Brian Henderson, but that was in the very early days of television. So he'd have grown up, I think if he was in Tenterfield or wherever it was, he'd have grown up with just radio to listen to and newspapers and magazines.
So, yeah, because it's still very much a rural area.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing a lot of research on you, obviously, before coming in here. There isn't a lot of people talking about what you were like with your teenage years going into early 20s about your sexuality. Obviously, you came out about 10 years ago now. But what age were you when you first started to think that maybe you were gay?
Wow. That's a great question. I can't really recall when that issue became, you know, front of mind. Probably in my early 20s, I suppose, when you think, wait a sec, what's going on here?
I didn't go through puberty until I was in my late teenage years. So my sexuality wasn't even something I knew about. Some of the kids at school would say, oh, you know, Ben's gay. And people seemed to know my sexuality before I knew what it was. My sexuality wasn't something that was pressing probably until my early 20s.
Yeah. You could be writing my story there. Because I had no idea about that sort of stuff, wasn't interested, and, you know, was entertaining or trying to entertain or deflect attention and not be bullied.
That's what I think it is. And, you know, I've heard that story quite a few times about kids at school who, not that they knew that they were gay, but it's deflecting other kids away from really knowing that about them, you know?
I didn't even know that. I was just doing it to not be picked on because I was, you know, sort of smaller than everyone else and younger. And didn't know anyone either, because in a boarding school of 500 kids, you know, you go away there not knowing one person.
Yeah.
It's tough.
If you could go back and give a message to yourself at like 12, what advice would you give yourself?
I would say follow your dreams, be resilient, give it a crack. You know, and that's actually what I tell anyone who says to me, well, look, what am I going to do? I want to get into the industry. I say, well, you know, make contacts and do radio. Very important to if you're interested in television or any kind of storytelling, radio, and if you can, a community radio station, because you may very well have more of an opportunity to speak rather than play music.
Also, getting that opportunity to develop an on-air personality as well, and working out the art of storytelling, I guess, is also important.
Mm. Along the way, I've always thought, well. And in television, this is what can happen. Just about every day, you can be summoned to the managing director's office and told, look, we absolutely love your work, but we're changing direction. And thanks a lot. We'll see you some other lifetime.
That happens to some people, but for you, they name a studio after you.
Well, it hasn't happened yet for me, but, you know, it's early in the day. But the thing is, so I always take the view that I'm just incredibly lucky to be part of the team and that these amazingly talented people will still work with me because the kids that we work with, when I say kids, you know, they're in their 20s, 30s, something like that, 40s even. Kids.
Lavinia's going to take that as a really good compliment. She'll be like, I'm in my 20s. Thank you very much, Peter.
Oh, she is. And the reporters and Tony Jones and all the people who are so brilliant at what they do. So you can cross to Lexi Daish, or actually, I shouldn't mention any of the reporters because
you don't want to single
them out. No, and they're all equally brilliant and fantastic. But they're young and And despite being young with maybe not huge amounts of life experience, they are really great. And they get what the story's about, and they're able to sum up a story concisely. And if we require 20 seconds from somebody ad-libbing standing at the side of the road talking about an accident they've just seen or whatever it is, they're able to nail it. And you think, how can you do that?
Mm.
You know, they are just absolutely fantastic, and they don't think twice about it.
But then I've seen a few times where there's been technical faults with you doing your job. You've been able to turn things around so quickly.
Well, you're
a professional and you've had years of experience.
Well, I'm not even sure of that. I just think it's because I just feel comfortable. And I think, well, if people are watching us, they'll put up with me. And so you feel like you're with friends. And that, so if I have to pop my glasses on to read a script because the prompter's broken down, I just let people know, well, this is what's going on, and they don't seem to mind.
Well, I think that your story wakes people up, and in your career you've sort of woken people up as well. What do you think is that magic behind the connection that you have with the audience? I mean, you can't see them, but yet you have a magic connection.
Oh, well, I'm most honoured that you would think that. I don't even think of it that way. I must say I'm interested in other people's stories.
Mm.
And that's why it's such a privilege telling people's stories.
Mm.
But I'm actually more interested in what they've got to say than what I have. That's again back to social media. It's terrific because you get a snapshot of what other people are thinking.
Yeah.
And it sort of keeps you contemporary, because you know, at 8,000 years old, you know, I could be whiling away the time until I'm not around anymore. But I think it's actually very good for you to be challenged and to, you know, to have to learn the latest apps or the latest operating systems or, you know, just keep up with what everybody else is doing.
What do you think makes a good anchor?
I have no idea. I think somebody you like. I mean, we have so many different styles in
reporting, I guess.
Yes, yeah. In reporting and presenting. Everyone has their own style, and you can't just, I don't think you can actually say this person is a good presenter or a good reporter and this one isn't. I think everyone, you know, if you can just tell the story and just be straight with people, because people sort of know, they know who you are, they know what the story is. Very seldom that there's somebody who's lovely on air and a swine in real life. I know this has happened recently in the United States for a revered actor there, but generally speaking, the audience knows who they're dealing with.
I think it's about authenticity. I think
that's actually it, isn't it?
It's when I connect to people on telly or anything like that, I always look at them. The more authentic they are, the more likely that you're going to be drawn to them.
Yes, well said. Your experience in reality television, having one Big Brother, that is the gutsiest thing, going on Big Brother and then winning the damn thing. You couldn't help but be authentic, I imagine, given that you're locked away for a long period of time.
I think it was more that I thought about what people were doing at that time of night, and I thought people watch Big Brother after they've finished work. I think that's about what you do as well, because you're in people's homes at a certain time of the night, they've had a busy day, and you're delivering them the news. Some warmth and some authenticity is what they're looking for.
Yep.
And I think that that's the magic behind connecting to an audience.
Actually, I think that's right. I think that's very well said. I think warmth also is important. We do these things instinctively without actually...
But that's
talking about them out loud.
I think sometimes just being natural about answering, like even interviewing people like this, the best parts of the interview is listening to people not rehearsing something, but thinking about something genuinely and then responding.
I feel like I've been put on the spot a lot today.
Yeah. Well, I said to you, you know, coming in here, I was like, I'd spoken to a lot of people. I said, oh, I'm interviewing Peter Hitchener, you know. And I thought, yeah, it's great to be able to have this conversation, because there are things about your life that I think people would love to know. But whether they are entitled to know is a different thing.
Well, I think people generally know my story. So, I don't normally sort of go on a lot about my private life, because most of my private life is about work. And I've never been too sure whether that is to make up for other things that aren't very busy in my life or what it is.
Who were your heroes growing up?
Wow, that's a great question. Early space exploration was interesting, the Sputniks and so on, which most people listening to would know, have no idea what I'm talking about.
It's fascinating listening to this and listening to you answer that question. But really, they, I guess, were the icons that were available to you growing up.
Yeah.
You know, you might ask that question to people now and they might be like, oh, you know, I don't know, Oprah or people that they've seen.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Know, that's who they're looking at that generation.
That's right. Yes, that's you know, I'm of that very geriatric generation.
You're like, no, there were the people we could hear on the radio. From the moment that you moved in and replaced Brian Naylor, was there a thought about what you would bring to the job? Was there a difference that you wanted to bring into that role?
I knew that I had quite a different style from Brian, and Brian's adored by people, and people had grown up with Brian because they'd seen him on Brian and the Juniors, and he'd worked at Channel 7 for years and then worked at Channel 9 for 20 years.
Mm.
And I always thought, well, because I was his deputy for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I always hoped to take over the role if and when he retired, but it never felt like he ever would because everything was going so well and, you know. But eventually in 1998 he did, and I was appointed to the job, and I thought, you know, at first I was thrilled. I thought, oh, well, you know, I've been promoted. And then I thought, wait, oh, hang on a minute, wait. And the other part of the equation clicks into place, and you realize, actually, there's, I don't know, 70, 80, 100 people in our newsroom and in the station who depend on me to do my job for a living. And if it doesn't work, I've gone, of course. But some others will
you've let other
job.
People down.
So I suddenly realised your responsibility to the team is huge, and that was the first thing. And I thought, well, I'm going to give it a right crack, and I'm going to if people ask me to do things, I'm going to do them. And if if there's a community organisation that needs somebody to come along and shake hands, I'll be there.
You're going to help them out.
Yes, help them out, because it's a way of being involved in the community and sort of giving, not giving back, but, you know, just supporting other community initiatives.
Well, I think it's a good philosophy to have. I think, you know, people who are successful do normally give back, and I think that's a great exchange for them to have. Throughout your career, though, is there a story that you have told doing the news that has stayed with you?
Oh, yes. Oh, look, there are lots. The sad stories or the bad stories are ones that really stay with you. So the Black Saturday bushfires, for instance, would have to be. It's just something that you don't sort of forget because it's so emotional, and it involved such a shocking loss of life, and it was such an unexpected tragedy. People were, you know, very hot weather in their homes, probably blinds down, air conditioners going, and this, you know, this monster fire was bearing down on them, and they didn't know. And so we went out in the field the next day, Tony Jones and I and some others from Nine, some other team members.
Mm.
We went up to Kinglake and Kinglake West in an SES convoy or a CFA convoy. I can't quite remember. I think it was people from both emergency services.
Yeah.
And this was pretty early on. This was the next morning, but there was still plenty of evidence, you know, trees were still smouldering and chaos and horrible. And I'll never forget driving up up towards Kinglake from Whittlesea. The further you got up the hill, all there were blackened tree trunks. There was no canopy and there was nothing on the ground, and it was quiet. Not a thing. And then we rounded a corner and there was an abandoned car, and there were other, you know, the closer we got to the Kinglake itself, there were other, you know, just things that you just don't want to see, you know, just stuff that is sort of symbolic of what happened.
Was it important for you in that role to go out there like that, or I mean, did they ask you to do, or did you feel like that was kind of a cathartic experience for you to go out there and see what it was after delivering the news?
Oh no, we were there delivering the news from there, because the Saturday night. See, the Saturday night, it wasn't really clear just what had happened, but the Sunday night. So we went up to Kinglake West on the Sunday morning, and the after effects of the fire were very evident, but I just couldn't help thinking how horrific it must have been for the people who were there and the people who perished. And we were on air, Tony Jones and I were on air doing the news, and we got word that Brian and Moiree had passed away also. In the middle of the news, we heard the news. So, you know, it was just shocking. And we continue to do reports from out in the field for the next couple of weeks. And people wanted to talk and wanted to tell their stories, and people wanted to... They just had to share it with somebody. Mm. And so walking around, you know, we spent most of the day there, and then we drive back to the station at nighttime. And so I got to speak to lots of people. They didn't want to talk on camera or anything. They just needed to talk to somebody.
And you were there doing it.
Well, yes. And
you didn't need to do that either.
Well, I think everyone who was there did, because, you know, we were there to sort of support one another. And it was shocking. And you know, you realize that those are times when you realize that we're there to do a service, and news has actually got to be a service to people. And if we're not a service to people, then there's no point in doing it. We've got to do something that makes people gives people information, or helps people deal with life's complexities, or makes them elated, or whatever it is. And so I got to realize then that we were actually doing something.
There's things that happen that are bad, and there's things that happen that is good.
Mm.
But I was going to ask you, what stories do you enjoy doing the most?
Well, I like the stories that make us laugh, because the happy stories make us realize that the sun will come up tomorrow. We live in a fantastic part of the world. We live in a glorious city. Mm. It's got problems, yeah, but, you know, hey, just take a look at the place. It's just fantastic. And also animal stories.
Yes.
And there was, oh, look, I've got to tell you about this. It was for a zoo special we did a year or so ago, a couple of years ago. And, you know, I got to go out on the road with the producer and the camera operators. And we... Judith Henke, who's just retired from the zoo after having been there for a long time, but she was their public relations officer.
Yeah.
And she arranged for us to go to various parts of the zoo that you don't get to go to, and one of them was the gorilla enclosure. So we went into where the zoo staff go, at the back of the gorilla enclosure. One of the gorillas was pregnant, and the vets had trained her to present her stomach to this little observation hole in the,
wow,
the wall, for them to feel whether the baby was growing the right way. And in order for her to just be relaxed and chillaxed about the whole thing, they just allowed a couple of people to come in and do the same thing. So there I was. They called the gorilla over and they said, now sit down and just put your hand out. And so looking into the gorilla's eyes, she let me touch her stomach. I can't tell you what it's like. Her eyes, just beautiful, intelligent, trusting eyes. Oh, I thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. The joys of my job when you get to do stuff like that.
I think it's interesting watching the news with your role. There's a real sense of family within the team with Joe Hall and,
oh, yes,
and Lavinia. Is that how it feels for you guys?
Oh, yes.
That it feels like a real family?
Oh, yes, very much so. We know each other. Look, I know it's very cliched to say, oh, we're a family, but actually we spend so much time with one another. We all know each other's stories. We know our quirks, our foibles. And as in a family, you have your ups and downs, but mostly they're ups, and mostly it's enormously supportive. Our team it's a very cohesive team. And so TJ, for instance, he is hilarious. Tony Jones, he's an incredible talent, because he has enormous news sense. So he can ad lib. He's a brilliant writer, and he's a great reporter, and he's very passionate about what he does. So he's very exhilarating to work with, and very funny as well. And Joe Hall, well, we've been friends for years, Joey, and Lavinia. I've got to stop calling her Livo, which is a bit of a nickname off air, but it's Lavinia on air.
Interestingly enough, there was a time where people were interested in you coming out. There was some stories going around.
Yep.
And did you feel that it was necessary to come out? Did you feel like it was something you felt pressured to do?
I felt that, look, the time is right. Just to officially say so, as I said, everyone knows my story, and everyone did, and I never made any bones about it. I didn't sort of didn't proclaim it from the top of the art center spire. But look, so I just thought, oh, It's about time, actually. In fact, I should have done so when I took over from Brian, but everyone was a bit uncertain about
it. Did you worry that it was going to affect your career, though?
At the time, yes, but there's been such a shift over the years in people's attitudes to things.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean that everyone feels the same way, but there's been a lot of change in the community. The yes vote showed that. People kind of don't care anymore because they think, oh, well, that's somebody else's business. It's their business, not mine, in the main. I mean, look, there's always going to be people who are upset by such things, but, you know, that's
just their story. That's
their story, yes. And also, in a way, what other people think of you doesn't matter.
I think it's so exhausting if you're worrying too much about what everyone's going to think of you.
Yeah, who could be bothered?
But I think it was interesting because there was a bit of a witch hunt at the time when it came to you coming out, and there was a bit of pressure on you to come out. And then when I was reading the articles about it, was there any truth to that? Was there someone trying to push you into doing this, or was it a decision that you made naturally?
Well, it was a decision. It was a tough decision. Sometimes you need a few little irritants or needles to get you to sort of do something. So you think, actually, just do it. When I was growing up, there was, you know, it was a much more phobic era, if I could say that.
Mm. No, definitely. I mean, I grew up in the 90s and I felt like that. My teenage years in the 90s, you know, at school, no one talked about it. It was something that was kind of frowned upon. So it was a different time. Mm. And then you look at it these days and, you know, kids are coming out a little bit earlier and there is more information that's available for them, which is great. And I'm hoping that it's easier for them to be able to come out.
I hope so, yes.
I remember hearing your story at the time and I felt proud.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
And it made an impact on my life because I thought I had such high regard for you. And then to see that you publicly came out, I felt proud to be the gay man. Because I thought,
oh, that's wonderful.
Maybe I can grow up to be like you.
No, I don't know what to say. Thank you. Oh. Sorry, very emotional moment there. Thank you.
Well, I think it's important to be able to talk about this sort of stuff because there's different generations and different things that happen to different people, and we struggle with our coming out. You worry about what people think,
yes,
and that they might feel better about themselves knowing that people who have important, powerful, well-respected jobs are people of the LGBTI community.
Exactly.
Were you relieved when you came out?
Oh, yes. I thought, well, nobody's got anything on me now. You know, there it is. It's out there. Go for your lives.
You know, it's funny when it happened as well, and I knew that at the time that you had a strong relationship with your sister.
Yes.
At what age did you tell her?
Well, I'm not sure that we've ever really even any of us had the conversation. It's just how it was. My family knew all along. You know,
and they never had a problem with it?
Not at all. Not at all. No, not at all. We just, you know, we were encouraged to be good to one another and be good to other people, and that's what makes life worthwhile. Whether, you know, who you are is, well, that's who you are.
Did you ever think it was nobody's business, though? Did you ever think, oh, maybe I shouldn't come out because really it's nobody's business?
Oh, no, it has. Look, in this day and age, especially as we've moved towards more and more towards the path of no privacy, whatever. I mean, you could have a drone hovering over your back garden or, you know, sort of doing sweeps of your house, taking photographs in this day and age. Pity help you if you're in the back garden sunbathing, but that's the way it is. So I don't think that I think those things are...
Why do people feel like they need to know everything about everyone?
Well, that's just the way it is. We all do know everything about everyone.
Yeah, I guess so.
With social media and so on. And look, that's just the way of the world. The world's changed and by and large, we're much better off now than we used to be. People who think, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to have this lovely thing the way it was in the 50s. Oh, spare me. You weren't in the 50s if you thought that was fun, because it wasn't.
Because it certainly wasn't.
No, not really. It was a quiet time of life where, you know, consisted of not a lot.
Yeah, not compared to what we have today. Mm. You know, should sports stars and other entertainers, is there going to be a change with them feeling more comfortable, do you think, of coming out?
Well, I can't speak for them. I think it's challenging, whoever you are, whatever role you're in. It can be challenging. You said that you found it hard.
Yeah, I think, and it's so funny because, I mean, I found it hard. People of my same age, when I've had this conversation, some people didn't find it as hard. You know, it's an individual story, and it completely changes about the circumstance that you're in. You know, for some people out there, you know, their parents weren't comfortable with it. And that makes it difficult for them. You know, for me, I was very lucky that when I came out, my parents were both like, we already knew and we didn't care.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. But it was such a pressure that I'd put on myself.
Mm.
And then when I was taken off, I think I've now always lived in this bubble, which I feel very thankful for. Now I'm like, I just talk about it.
Actually, that pretty much says how it was for me in a way too. And on the one hand, it's not something that, certainly when I was growing up, that my peers thought well about. But for me, I thought, oh, yeah, it's no big deal, really. No.
Did you ever hear rumours and think, oh, why are they gossiping about that, or you just didn't care?
Oh, no, I didn't care, because there's always rumours about everybody.
It's such a personal question I need to ask you this, but, like, you know, over the years, you know, you haven't had a long-term partner.
Yeah, well, yes, I have my partner's probably been my work, I don't know.
Do you have room, do you think, in your life to have a partner?
I don't know, who knows? I suppose so, it could happen, but you know, I'm just pottering along.
I guess if you met the right person, then you could probably make the space.
I suppose.
Have you ever had someone come in? I mean, do people come and hit on you?
Oh, no. No.
Come on, over the years.
Oh, maybe they did, but that was back about 100 years ago.
Look, there's obviously different levels of satisfaction in what you've achieved. And, you know, you've worked in different charities and you've done so many different things in your career. What is the thing that you look back at and feel the most amount of satisfaction about?
Wow, gosh, there's a whole lot of things I'm pleased to have done.
Mm.
I'm pleased to, from a professional point of view, very pleased to have worked in television at a time when it was its golden era.
Mm.
When I started, it was about the time of the Vietnam War and the protests and so on, and covering a very divisive sort of war that caused all sorts of social upheaval here, back here in Australia, the moratoriums and things. But actually covering news from those days, the moonwalks, all that sort of thing, through to today, I think, gosh, I've actually got to in a way, report on things that really, you know, that it's not my doing or anything, but I'm just telling people at home about, well, this is what's going on. So that's been good. I like that. I've worked with John Sorrell, who was one of the great figures of Melbourne journalism, and Michael Venus, and now Hugh Nailon, our boss. I've worked with fantastic people, Eric Pierce, Brian Naylor. So, you know, professionally, that's been enormously satisfying. So
you're also linked to quite a few different charities as well. Which charities have you decided to align with over the years?
Oh, gosh. Well, the first one was the Deaf Blind. It used to be the Deaf Blind Association. That was Eric Pierce was involved, who I also worked with, of course. He was their patron, and then I've been an ambassador for them since his passing. And now it's called Able Australia, and it's not just for the deafblind community. It's for people with a variety of physical challenges. Let me think, who else? Oh, there's lots of ambassadorships. There's the Zoo, Eastern Health, Barwon Health in Geelong, the Geelong Hospital Network, which stretches pretty much over to the South Australian border. They have all sorts of services offered. They're terrific. Eastern Health in Melbourne. I don't want to leave anybody out. There's a new group called Youth Activating Youth, which I've been to a couple of their functions. And it's kids of all backgrounds, but it's for disengaged kids. The idea is to have them back in the community, and they're maybe South Sudanese youth and others. And it's a way, you know, the idea is to promote sport and have them have kids doing things rather than being disengaged and maybe making wrong choices. So that's interesting. And another thing we do is, the thing I like supporting is Operation New Start. And this is, again, for it's run by the Education Department, but they choose kids from their area, and the schools nominate kids who might be in danger, youth at risk sort of thing, kids, boys and girls, who might be in danger of running off the tracks. They're usually year nine. And for a whole term, these kids don't go to school except one day a week. For the rest of the time, they're involved in physical activities, intellectual activities, training, all sorts of things to just get them to, you know, break
engage
out. Engage. And so for one day a term, they come into Channel 9 and we have them reading news and doing stuff like that and just seeing, oh, there are other possibilities ahead. Mm. You know, have a look at, you know, maybe makeup or hair or journalism or lighting or camera operators or, you know, all the things, just to sort of, just to give them an idea about something else, and also to let them see what happens behind the scenes in news and media.
But then also it goes to show you just how active you have been with the communities.
Well, look, this is not my doing, it's their doing, and they do a fabulous job. They're just amazing.
All you the don't volunteers have to necessarily turn up to people's graduations, oh, but you're there.
Oh, no, that's good. I took one of our chief of staff, but our unit manager. Mm. I took Gab when she was our unit manager before she went overseas. She came along with me to one of the graduations, and the poor thing, she was in tears the whole way through because she'd met the kids when they came into Channel 9, and then hearing their stories and, you know.
I'm an emotional person, so that would be me. I'd be the first person sitting there crying.
So were the parents, so was everybody. It was terrific.
It's hard. I think it's hard not to be emotional with those sorts of stories. Working at 70 and being in your prime, in your career, is age just a number to you?
Oh yes, I don't think about it. I'm happier now, I think, than I used to be, and I think I'm fitter as well. I'm committed to. I know anyone listening to this will think, "Oh, what are you talking about, you silly thing?" I do circus training.
Get now, out!
I'm not talking about juggling or riding a monocycle. Although I think I'd quite like to do that one day, but this is things like Roman rings, handstands, headstands, that sort of stuff, which I just love. And so I go along whenever I can and do that sort of thing. And it's amazingly good.
It's good fitness.
I feel healthy. Yes, I feel healthy. I could lose a couple of kilograms, but anyway, who's counting?
I just think it's so funny because you think about it, like, what's the key to aging gracefully? Your answer is joining the circus.
Yes. Oh, wouldn't it be wonderful? Wouldn't it be amazing? Oh, I can't tell you what it's like. And we have a tissue. It's not a very high tissue at the gym I go to, but it's enough. So you can climb the tissue, do all the sort of the catches hang or the hangers catch. I never know what it's called. And all that sort of stuff. And get yourself upside down and hang there. It's just amazing. It's really good.
If you, looking back over everything so far, like, is there anything that you would have done differently?
I'd have started doing this years ago.
You'd started the circus earlier.
Yes. Maybe I'd run away and join the circus. Well, it's entertainment. You know, it's a career in entertainment. It's not news, but it would have been fun.
You know, we've been on a real journey with, you know, I guess what sexuality means in Australia, and it's been a bit of a roller coaster over the last few years. What impact did you see in your role that marriage equality had? Like, as in last year when marriage equality was being rolled out, do you think it was about marriage from your perspective, or do you think it was more about equality?
Oh, I just saw it as equality. I, of course, don't, in the news, you don't get to campaign for or against things. Mm. You don't get to take sides in politics.
Are there times that you do think,
or you feel like it? Yes. And that was one of them, because I just thought it's just about equality. Mm. It's great if people want to get married, but it's about
making sure that everyone has equal rights,
for goodness sake.
How far away do you think it would be before we'd see trans people reporting and being on the news?
I should think it'll happen in due course.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not a matter of a judgment about that issue. It's just about, well, some, you know, the people who are in the jobs at the moment are who they are, and when they retire, those sort of questions come up.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't see any reason why not.
Exactly. But I think we have definitely come a long way.
Oh, yes.
You know, in being a little bit more accepting or looking at things a little bit different.
Yep.
Mm. Who are your favourite Australian exports that have gone overseas?
Oh, gosh, that's another great question. Well, I love Deborah Lee. I don't know. It's just good to see Aussies doing well overseas, whoever they are. And you know, sometimes, you know, at the I nearly said the Logies, but I meant the Oscars. an Australian, somebody wins an award for something, you know, behind the scenes. And you think, great, good work. So
you still feel quite patriotic that way?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do, because it's always good when somebody who isn't expected to triumph does so.
I love the underdog.
Same here.
That's my favourite thing.
Same here.
When you see the underdog doing well, mm-hmm. I don't know why it resonates with me, mm-hmm. but it feels more powerful.
Absolutely.
I'm always rooting for them. Look, there's so many people out there that are probably listening to this right now and loving the opportunity that we've got to sit down and have some questions about your life, and I appreciate you sharing. But do you have a message for the queer community that might be out there listening to this?
It would be a message for everybody, anyone. Have fun. Be good to everyone. Be resilient. Keep smiling. The sun will come up tomorrow. Make the most of every opportunity. How lucky we are. We live in the most wonderful city, most wonderful country. And don't let things get you down. Hang in there.
That's what's worked for you, I guess.
Yes.
It's a good mantra to have.
Yes. It's probably a little bit Pollyanna-ish, but anyway, that's how I see the world.
I think there's something that works with simplicity as well.
Mm.
You know, like, I think for some people, they overcomplicate things sometimes. Mm. And I think sometimes just keep it simple, stupid.
Yep. I'm with you.
And it'll all work out. Peter Hitchener, thank you so much for joining us on Word for Word.
Benjamin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.